Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour. And we are back after our midsummer break and we're raring to go, bringing you news and stories about food and drink in Cambridge.
Thanks to Tony Barnfield for that last hour.
I'm Matt Bentman.
And I'm Alan Alder. And today we bring you the truth about top Cambridge chefs' guilty food secrets. We name names and identify the foods.
We also meet Stephen Marsh, who tells us the fascinating story of his Pinkster Gin, how it came about, and the three spin-off products that have come from it. In addition, Tina Roshan Leeds Young from the Cambridge Cookery and Bistro will be talking about food with Sam and Alex from Restaurant 22.
Dave Fox is here with advice on how to help your plants cope with this hot, dry weather. And we'll hear about a forthcoming event matching English wines with British food at Robinson College.
And we also have the Cambridge food and drink news, a look at what's being tweeted this morning, and what food and drink are on offer for nothing via the Olio app.
Let's begin with gin. Flavour regular Dr. Sue Bailey met up with Stephen Marsh of the hugely popular Pinkster Gin at the Pinkston Ball in the Plough at Shepreth recently. Sue asked him about Pinkster and how it began.
Pinkster is a hobby that's grown wildly out of control. I started making Pinkster about 14 years ago following a problem I had with yeast and sugar. I had 4 years on the wagon. After 2 years on the wagon, you go to your doctor and say, I've got a drinking problem and I can't. They tend not to take it quite as seriously as you think they should. And eventually, the fifth doctor I saw said he knew what the problem was. And he thought the problem was yeast and sugar, so I cut yeast and sugar out of my diet for 2 years. And then he said, right, you can start drinking again, but then you drink gin or vodka. And vodka's really boring, but gin, I thought, was fantastic, but doesn't go with food. So I started to experiment to see whether I could make a gin that I could drink with food. And it took me a year before I had a eureka moment and I discovered that raspberries, fresh raspberries, took the edge off juniper. And then I spent another 3.5 years perfecting the balance of botanicals to give me a clean and refreshing drink that I could drink all evening. I had no intention to do it commercially. 3 or 4 years later, I was persuaded by friends that I should do it commercially. In other words, I had several friends who said, look,
please,
and they put up some money, and so we gave it a try. And that was 5 years ago now. We started early 2013. I made 4,000 litres of Pinkster in 2013. I made 100,000 litres of Pinkster in 2017, and I'm going to make 200,000 litres in 2018. We now sell it around the world, but we only make Pinkster during the raspberry season. We start late June and we carry on to the end of October. I think much more like a wine producer actually than a distiller, because I'm very interested in the crop. We've had an interesting season so far. Actually, the raspberries are slightly later than normal, and you can get English raspberries at the moment, but they don't really have the flavour. Foreign raspberries never have the flavour. You know, so I'm not going to start making Pinkster with Moroccan raspberries in December.
No.
Because they just don't do it.
So do you source your raspberries locally?
The raspberries are grown in Milton. We're very local. We have very, very low food miles. And we have absolutely no waste. Because when I finish making Pinkster, I'm left with raspberries. And there are other brands running TV campaigns at the moment. And I had to ask, what do they do with the spent fruit if they're making it? What we do with the spent fruit is that we put the berries in jars and sell them as boozy berries. The berries that aren't good enough to go in jars, we turn into gin jam. And when we finish making the gin jam, the liquid the berries have been preserved in, we are now bottling and selling as Pinkster Royale. Now, that is and it is absolutely superb. A dash of Pinkster Royale in a glass of Prosecco.
So it's a bit like a sort of cassis idea.
Yes, absolutely. But it's a skinny cassis because we don't add sugar.
Ah, so you're just using natural sugars from the raspberries.
Well, we don't, yeah.
Perfect.
And we don't touch it, but a dash of that in a glass of Prosecco. The dryness of the Pinkster Royale complements the sweetness of the Prosecco. It's intensely raspberry.
Sounds gorgeous. And is this the new product that you've just literally launched?
Well, we launched it a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Four weeks ago. If somebody had said to me 6 months ago that I would have a third byproduct out of Pinkster, I wouldn't have believed them. But actually we have. And I thought, this is interesting, we'll do it. We had enough for about just under 3,000 bottles. We've sold 1,000 bottles in 4 weeks, and I'm now worrying that I've built up demand I'm not going to be able to satisfy.
Oh, crumbs, yes.
So, but it's available from Cambridge Wine Merchants. It's a byproduct, so you know, we're trying to work out how we can make more of it next year.
Make more gin.
And we're doubling production this year. We're going to make 200,000 litres. It's quite possible that we may end up making 250,000 litres. But the Pinkster Royal is at the end of the chain, and we have to see how it goes.
Indeed.
And I won't compromise on it. Mm. We also make some fantastic pudding gins, which we have under the brand name of Hedge Pig.
Ah, yes, I've heard of Hedge Pig.
Yes. And we're going to drink some this evening.
Mm. Excellent. Tell me a bit more about Hedge Pig. Why Hedge Pig?
Well, Hedge Pig,
lovely name.
It's a lovely name. What we wanted was, because I used to be really keen on port and pudding wines, but I still really can't drink them. And I'd always made fruit gins, and actually fruit gins are really good with puddings.
Now I haven't tried that.
Yeah. So, you know, they're sweet, but they're gin-based rather than wine-based. And tonight we're having an elderflower pudding gin, which is absolutely delicious. We picked the name Hedge Pig because it was a made-up word. We made it up. And we wanted something that had connotations of foraging, because actually we do go out, you know, most of our ingredients are foraged rather than commercially produced.
That's lovely. And that's such a lovely story. But also, isn't a hedge pig a hedgehog?
It is. Another name for hedgehog. And 50p for every bottle we sell is donated to the Hedgehog Preservation Society.
Can I just ask, did you have a background in distilling?
No, not at all. I read history at university. I read history, so all I knew about distilling. I'd done a module on the ancient Egyptians and distilling. So all I knew about distilling was from ancient Egyptians. Do you know, it hasn't really changed terribly much.
Your production is in Newton.
Our production is in Newton. It was in Bali, it was in my garden shed. For 3 years we were doing it in my garden shed. And I always like saying my garden shed, because everybody imagines
the rustic shed.
Six foot by 4 foot. Actually it was a 2,000 square foot barn, but,
big shed.
But you know, but it was in my garden.
Also, I think the imagery that you have for Pinkster is absolutely lovely. I think that's one of the lovely parts of your brand.
Thank you very much.
It's very stylishly English.
Yes.
I think it's charming. It's really charming.
Well, we try. I mean, so many... there are so many gin brands out there. And there's now nearly 1,000 brands you can buy in the UK. And a lot of them are very, very interested in how they make everything. I'm more interested in people actually tasting it. And then when people taste it, then they want to know more about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really interested in boring people's socks off about, you know...
The process.
Yes,
exactly.
If anybody's interested in the process, I'm very happy to go through it. But actually, most people aren't. There is a slightly... A lot of brands are much more interested in about themselves than they are about their consumer.
True.
I'm more interested in the consumer.
Yes.
And that... I ran a marketing agency for 18 years, and I understand the consumer is the most important.
Exactly. And if the consumer doesn't like the product, they won't buy the product.
Besides which, I'm having so much fun.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds brilliant.
Yeah, that is brilliant. That's such an impressive story.
Yeah, isn't it impressive the way he uses everything? Was it 3 byproducts?
Yeah.
Plus doubling his output this year compared to last year. It's a success. Yeah.
Good economics and good environmental practice.
Now, Stephen has a very interesting and unusual guilty food secret. Well, a food and drink secret, really, I suppose, if you can call Mars bars a food. And we'll be hearing about that later in the programme.
Cambridge chefs and food producers do have some very interesting guilty food secrets. We'll be covering some today and some next time with a little bit more detail and actually a bit more sort of explanation. But let's kick off with a voice very well known to listeners of Flavour, Rosie Sykes. And Rosie is followed by Rachel Roddy, who writes in The Guardian's feast section on Saturdays, and then by Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern. Rosie, have you got any guilty food secrets?
Well, I have quite a few, I think, but I would say my main one is tinned semolina or tinned macaroni, the sweet, the I think it's Ambrosia does a range of cream, like milk puddings, really old fashioned. And that would be one of my guilty pleasures. Just warmed up with some jam plopped in it, like at school. But my other one would be a peanut butter and cucumber sandwich but on really soft white bread. I think that counts, does it?
Thank you very much. What's your guilty food secret, Rachel?
I don't know, probably like standing in front of the fridge and eating. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that's even really feel guilty anymore. I don't generally feel very guilty. I'll tell you what I do feel guilty, it shouldn't, is that my son, everyone says to me, Luca must eat so brilliantly. And actually, when I'm recipe testing, him and Vincenzo, they eat whatever I am testing. So if I'm testing, you know, two jam tarts and a chocolate cake, both of which that have gone wrong, that is their tea. So I feel slightly guilty about my son's premature tooth decay. But
salt and vinegar crisps and Ferrero Rocher, not necessarily together.
Well, there you have it. Part one of our fearless expose. More throughout the programme.
Yeah, will you be revealing your food secrets, Alan?
Oh, well, I might divulge one of them. What about you?
I think we'll leave my one for the next episode, but that semolina one that Rosie was going on about. You know, I never touched semolina as a kid at school because I used to be I love the Roald Dahl books. And what his autobiographical one, Boy, would go on about all the horrible school dinners that they would do. And that put me off school dinners for life. I was strict packed lunch. You know, from that point. And I've always wondered about semolina. I don't think I've ever had it.
Oh, I think it's nice, actually, but yeah. But you don't expect to come up in everyday conversation. We usually keep it to ourselves. By the way, the last voice in that sequence was Tristan Welch. His Parker's Tavern in the University Arms Hotel in Regent Street here in Cambridge has been carrying out a soft and gentle opening this week and is doing for the next couple of weeks. And I was invited along and I had breakfast there on Wednesday and dinner on Thursday.
What did you think?
It was marvellous. I mean, the hotel itself is beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. It's been beautifully and elegantly furnished and done up. The walls are just full of pictures and with a Cambridge sort of basis. And they've all been chosen carefully. And you can see they've been chosen carefully by the owner. And there's a library, the old library, in which you will eventually be able to sit and have afternoon tea. The books there, as soon as I walked in, I thought, God, I'd like to read that book and that one and that one. And again, they've all been, you know, because a lot of places buy books by the yard just to fill places like this. But these have all been individually chosen. And they say they really want people, if they're sitting in there having tea, if they want to go and read a book, they can get a book out and sit and read it while they're enjoying whatever it is they're eating.
Grand, eh?
But the food, I mean, at breakfast, I mean, I like French pastries, so pain au chocolat, croissants, you know, I adore.
Yeah.
And I can honestly say, having eaten pain au chocolat in France, in Britain, you know, this was the best I have ever had. It was wonderful.
Nah,
and today is National Chocolate Day, so. And then the dinner, well, one of the desserts, the dinner was wonderful. It looked good, it tasted good, it was artfully prepared, as you would expect, really. But one of the puddings, the Duke of Cambridge tart, I think it was called, Tristan said it took them 35 times to get that right, 35 sort of incarnations. They changed things 35 times until they were satisfied with it. And it was wonderful. And one of the people we went with, who was wise enough to choose it, said it was the best pudding she had ever eaten. So it's a really, really good place. It's friendly. It was exciting being there because it's new, but there was just a lovely, joyous atmosphere. I really, really recommend it. Opens on the 1st of August. You can book now. And I will be booking. You know, I shall go back without question.
That certainly is a lot of plaudits, isn't it? From the details of the books through to the pain au chocolat, through to the Duke of...
Right? The Duke of Cambridge.
Duke of Cambridge,
sorry.
Yeah. Sounds great.
It was. Go there.
Well, on now to the last in this series of conversations about food. Today, Tina Roche and Liz Young of Cambridge Cookery and Bistro are talking with Alex and Sam Carter from the very highly regarded Restaurant 22 in Chesterton Road.
We were working in a pub together. I was a waitress and Sam was the chef.
11 years ago this summer, yeah.
Yeah.
So we've been in Cambridge for 3.5 years. We saw a big gap in the market, as in You can go out for a nice meal, but nothing special. You've got Alimentum, which is lovely. You've got Midsummer, which is amazing, but... Yeah.
Special occasion place.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we felt there was a bit of a middle ground that we could aim ourselves at.
So where were you then, Sam, in the 3 years when you were commuting from here?
I worked for UBS Bank. There were 7,500 people in the building, and we had... It was about 50 chefs in total, and
yes.
It was pretty much a Monday to Friday a la carte restaurant.
So a large team then in the
large
kitchen?
Large team, so I think I had about 14 at one point. So it's a bit different now to go into a 22-cover restaurant with three chefs, but it's nice. It's really manageable.
So this dream to work for yourselves, when did that start to take shape then?
So when we first met, we had a really amazing couple managing us, Jack and Carolyn. Jack was a big inspiration to you, wasn't he? And Carolyn was to me. She was amazing front of house, just so charismatic and could run the room so well.
I think their sort of thing was to run it like one big dinner party. So they had about a 50-cover pub in the countryside. It was a really nice pub.
Yes.
They just cared about everyone. Rather than it being like a restaurant, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I think that's really very much part of what people appreciate about an independent place, isn't it? I think we can see that here, that we all know our customers very, very well, and they, you know, we know which table they like and we know what their preferences
and
are.
And you know when an order
you have
comes
a chat.
In.
Yes, yes.
If it's a particular person. So when someone walks in and you know that they have that sort of coffee, to me, if you're making that coffee for them as soon as they open the door, that's how I would want it.
And you do that equally, don't you, with the front of house treatment and, of course, the food, because, you know, your food, Sam, is amazing.
Thank you.
Where was your main inspiration then, do you think?
I worked at Hambleton Hall, so I worked in pubs around the area, and then that really opened my eyes working there. I was there for about a year, but the fresh produce, the seasonality, and working in that environment where it's quite intense, it's Michelin star, it's five rosettes, I believe, and it's hard work, but really learned a lot, taking a good ingredient and showcasing it is what I've sort of carried on.
Not complicating it too much.
No. Yeah, nice and simple. And that was a big inspiration. And then obviously working down in London, I worked for Gordon Ramsay for 2.5 years, I think it was. And
which of the restaurants were you in?
I was at Maze. It was a bit of everything. It was like a lot of covers, but it was really good quality as well. So we were doing like 150 for lunch, maybe 250 for dinner.
Your menu, do you change it daily or how do you...
There's nothing on the menu for more than 2 weeks.
Apart from macaroni cheese and Guinness bread.
That's stayed.
And that's a lunchtime item, presumably, or both?
Both.
Really? Yes.
Yeah, so with the tasting menu, we do some snacks at the start. One of them is like deep-fried truffle macaroni cheese and everyone just loves it.
It's a bit of a guilty pleasure, I think.
Wow, that does sound amazing.
Yeah, it's really yummy.
Which so cheeses are you using in that then?
Aged Comté.
Comté is just the best.
It's quite Moorish. It's quite Moorish.
That and Gruyere, I think. Those nutty flavours are amazing. So, and then you deep fry it as well.
Yeah. It's only a little bit, so it's fine.
Yeah. Did it feel scary or was it just so busy you didn't have time to think about it? Okay, so we've both left our jobs now. We've taken on this mortgage. Now it's got to work.
I don't think we got a chance to think about it too much. It was 100 miles an hour, wasn't it? It was just like, okay. And you got to roll with it.
And you just had to keep making the decisions, I think, otherwise everything would slow down. Mm. We chose an opening date and we took bookings, so we had to be ready for that day.
Probably a good way to tell you, isn't it?
We were still painting the lunchtime of the opening evening.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit...
Wow, that is touching.
Yeah. It was a bit hairy, but we just about got there.
Yeah, we got there and we're happy it's... Something that close to the centre of town. I mean, it's like an 8-minute walk into the centre.
Absolutely,
yeah, it's pretty clear. Yeah, it's a good location.
By the river and the whole area, it's sort of, you've got the watermill on the corner, we've got...
Thirsty.
The guys are thirsty.
It's very much sort of a quite happening area now, isn't it? And a good solid community and people are looking for local places, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So we were living south of the river by Mill Road before, and so I was a bit nervous about moving and living north of the river. Oh, goodness. We were spoiled, really, on Mill Road with all sorts of places, and the Petersfield pub had not been open long, and that was fabulous, and the Geldart and other places.
Norfolk Street Bakery.
Yeah, exactly. But we love it. It's great. We've been exploring Chesterton, and I think, like you say, it is really up and coming. A thirsty beer garden has just opened.
Well, that's a nice place to spend a Sunday.
We're kind of getting there now, aren't we?
And have you found good suppliers, do you think, buying local things?
We started off with fairly reliable suppliers and I'm starting now to expand that a little bit. I've just taken on a new butcher called the Rare Breed Meat Company, and they're based in Colchester. as I was on the phone here, I've just ordered like a Herefordshire 50-day aged beef.
Sirloin
for next week. And we train all of our staff on that so that if somebody does ask, they can give them the right information rather than I'll check.
Yeah. Oh, it's so important, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think that's what people are after now. They want to go out and they want the full experience rather than just a nice plate of food. They want to know about it. They want to know where it's from. And
I think it is. We get asked a lot, and you know, our fish, not just our fish suppliers, but actually asking them much more in-depth questions because even for sustainable fish, it's not always quite how we want it. Yeah. And the meat as well, you know, it takes a bit of digging to get it right.
Yeah.
And it's been sort of 6 months of turning everything around, but a lot of people are asking about it and saying, I see you got this, so what has it meant? And people want to know what's on their plates, apart from the fact that it just tastes better, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, it does. Yeah. Have you found that you've stuck with the same suppliers or have you changed things up quite a lot?
We changed relatively recently our fish supplier. To me, suppliers are someone that I want to be able to pick up the phone and have a chat to. We're also very lucky. We order from COFCO, so the organic. They also send us boxes of any surplus veg that they can't sell on to their customers, which we then turn into food for Jimmy's once a week. Which
no longer
is perfectly, to me it looks perfect, but to other people maybe not, but then at least someone's getting it, it's not getting, I mean it still goes to the pigs for pig feed, which in the end comes back to you in that cycle, but at least we're feeding someone. And then we also have a lovely relationship with a farm on the way to St. Neot sort of area called Croxton Park. They're an organic farm, beef and pigs and lamb.
So do you guys change your menu based on that? So what they say is good?
Yeah. Well, the Saturday night, yes, we do. So it changes every week.
We normally post it on a Monday because we know what we've got and anything extra that they can get us. But it's totally led by what we're getting. It does feel very nice to do it that way.
I think it's the best way to do it.
Yeah.
It's one of the only ways to do it.
It is. And the taste is just so extraordinary. I mean, we often get comments on even the very simple dishes on a brunch menu, where it's just, say, bread and egg, basically. And it's our handmade sourdough. You know, it's properly free-range eggs where the birds are going outside. And I think people just realise that they can taste the difference. So when you get that question, how can something so simple taste so good? It's more to do with the produce and any skill in the kitchen. Obviously, it has to be cooked right, but it is just letting the produce speak for itself, isn't
Definitely.
It?
Eat it when it's ready to be eaten and when it's at the right time.
So in the season, like Croxton Park, they have these amazing tomatoes that he just... So they look ugly, like they normally do, but the flavour is just stunning.
Oh, they're fantastic, those tomatoes.
It's like, I'm waiting for tomatoes. Yeah. Roll on, roll on.
A guy came to see me on Saturday. His name's Jake. He's got a company called Seed to Feed, and it's all the little microcresses, radishes, baby turnips, mustard frills.
Well, that sounds interesting. Yeah. We would be interested in meeting Jake.
I'll send him your details. So he's ringing me after we finish here. He literally picks the cress that morning and brings it to the restaurant.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful stuff.
You put it on Saturday night, didn't you? The mustard frill, was it? And we had so many comments on it.
Really?
Yeah, just a tiny, tiny leaf, but so much flavour in it. It's amazing.
Yeah.
That's the pros of having your own place, isn't it? That you can just change if you want.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just reprint that menu.
Yeah. Yep.
Last minute. It's fine. Yeah.
Our team as well, we've got to mention our team because I don't think we have yet. We're so lucky. We've got six
blessed
full-time members of staff, and the passion between the little team, it pushes everybody.
Yeah.
From the sous chef to the sommelier to the head waitress.
Yeah, we've got an amazing girl called Mel.
Is it?
Yeah,
she's
fantastic.
She is amazing.
Yes.
She's infectious. She's so keen and like so passionate about food and service and everything like that.
Yeah.
And that rubs off on everyone. We learned a few lessons. Everybody wants a table between 7 and 8.
Yeah.
But sometimes you can't do 34 covers
in an hour.
At 7 courses each. My advice would be, as soon as you think you're prepared, you're probably about halfway.
Yeah.
I think there's so much, there's so many things you don't even think of.
Yeah.
And I think there should be a handbook.
Do you think there should be a handbook? I think it's quite good that people think they know that they've got all those things. It's sort of like, just watch them.
I think we had a 100-page business plan, well, 100-plus-page business plan, and there's a lot of things we were missing.
Yeah, so far.
Well, we're very the south side, and you're now north side, aren't you? Just north of the river, so 22 Chesterton Road. Good luck with developing a name that was already known, but that has changed so much in your hands already.
It's been so fun to chat to you.
Yeah, it's been nice to be nosy.
It's nice to compare suppliers.
It's like, ooh, I've picked the one.
Yes.
There we go, the familiar song and music signals that it's time for the latest food tweets from the city. Alan?
Yeah, been quite a few this morning. A couple football related. Pint Shop in Peas Hill and Smokeworks in Station Road both have barbecue food available and, of course, beers available this afternoon. Pint Shop from 1 till 5. And actually, Smokeworks always has barbecue-style food available. Cambridge Cookery and Bistro, I should say, there are a few tables available tonight, so you can book via their website. Calverley's Brewery in Hooper Street, food there today is Neapolitan street food. And if you're going to the Latitude Festival this summer, Meatless will be there, so that's rather nice. And rather inappropriately, it's National Chocolate Day today, so lots of melted chocolate about the country, I imagine.
Now, onto an unusual idea for a drink, which I think definitely fits into the guilty category. Here is Sue Bailey interrogating Stephen Marsh from Pinks to Gin.
Last question, what is your guilty food secret?
Oh. Well, my guilty food secret, actually, I really like Mars Bar vodka. And you make Mars Bar vodka by putting vodka in a jam jar, half full of jam jar with vodka, chop up a Mars Bar, put the chopped up Mars Bar in the jam jar, put the lid on tight, put it in the dishwasher.
In the dishwasher?
In the dishwasher.
Oh, wow.
And let it go through a cycle, take it out, shake it, and put it through another cycle. And when it's been through the second cycle, take it out, let it cool. Perhaps then, when it's cooled, put it in the freezer. And you have an absolutely delicious Mars Bar vodka.
That sounds so naughty.
It is.
We have made Skittle vodka, and frankly, that was not worth making. But
no.
Mars Bar vodka sounds brilliant.
That is my guilty food secret.
Thank you, I love it.
I love it too. Have you ever tried anything like that, Matt?
Nothing like that. I mean, I've always wanted to try the fried Mars Bar, the deep fried Mars Bar in Scotland. I've never. Have you tried that?
No. We were in Edinburgh or Glasgow a little while ago. We did see it in fish and chip shops. So no, I didn't.
That was an elaborate one. Blimey.
Yeah, right. Anyway, the next Fearless expose in a few minutes' time will be of Alex Rushmer, ex-hole in the wall and popping up about town.
Yes, and that comes after this feature, in which Alexis Moreau and Alice Archer are talking about their forthcoming British food and English wines evening at Robinson College.
This themed evening will be around English wine and British food. The starter, after a welcome drink that will be available for our guests, will be based on fish and seafood that are coming from the British coast. Paddock, salmon, and it will be just put together into a traditional way of a puff pastry pie, and then will be served with tomato and gremolata and some micro watercress as well. The vegetarian option will be an assortment of cannellini beans, spinach, Gruyere cheese, and again made in a pastry, and will be topped with a puff pastry lid as well. And that will be again accompanied with tomato and dill gremolata and macro watercress.
Right. Alice, there's a lot of flavours in there, especially considering there's the vegetarian option alongside the fish. Does that produce any particular challenges in finding a suitable wine?
In some ways it's quite exciting, so it means you've got different aspects of the dish going especially well with the wine, different aspects of the dish going well with different parts of the dish. Something like the puff pastry going through both of them, it's going to be quite a rich buttery feel and texture, which will go quite nicely with some of the wine, will certainly help to complement the wine. We're serving this with a Blanc de Blanc sparkling wine, so a white sparkling wine made from white grapes. It's all Chardonnay. It's from a brand new producer called Rathfinny. They are about 10 miles as the crow flies from the sea, And this dish just does work really perfectly. You can, on a clear day, it's right down on the coast, not too far away from Brighton and Lewes, that kind of area. On a clear day, you can just see straight out to the sea. And fish pie is exactly what I had when I visited the estate for the first time and had it with this wine.
Well, let's move on to the main course. What's on offer there?
We are very excited about this main course because we are offering a char-grilled loin of free-range English pork, which actually is coming from East Anglia, so just around the corner. Going to be served with confit of pork wrapped in pancetta. We're also serving some Jersey royals, asparagus, rainbow carrots, and a wide mushroom and sep sauce, which is really... We are right on the seasonal product, local product, exactly what we wanted to achieve. For the vegetarian option, we will be serving grilled halloumi cheese with heritage beetroot texture, roquette, pear, pistachio, nut, pesto, Jersey Royal, and again, a selection of asparagus and rainbow carrots.
Alice, so what about the wine for this?
And yes, so wine-wise, there were lots of ways we could have gone with this. Pork is quite a versatile meat, really. You can go white, red, rosé, sparkling, depending on what's alongside. We've actually gone for something which isn't very common, which is an English red wine. There are a few more being produced, but we do struggle climate-wise to fully ripen the skins. I mean, you've got resolved tannins and texture in the wine. But we've gone for a wine from Chapel Dam called Union Red, which is a nice blend of Pinot Noir, a little bit of a grape called Rondo, and also some earlier ripening Pinot Noir called Pinot Precoce.
Right, Rondo's not a well-known grape.
It did get planted quite early on in the English wine industry. So in the 80s, they did plant grapes like Bacchus and Rondo. Those were all being planted at the same time as these are sort of hybrid grapes, so to speak. Then they've been designed specially to ripen earlier and be better in cooler climates, both here and in other less well-known wine-producing countries across Europe. And then the beetroot as well will work really well with this red, some nice fruity earthiness behind it, but not too much tannin that will fight with the food.
Just as a diversion, given the summer we are now having,
yeah,
will English Pinots fully ripen, do you think?
If the weather continues like this, there is a strong potential. Flowering is really happening in full flow at the moment. I saw some vines last week in England and, yeah, absolutely covered in flowers. So hopefully, if it continues like this, we'll get a really nice fruit set. If we do suddenly get a cold snap, then that could be a problem. We get a lot of rains, but it's agriculture, that's what happens.
Yes. You know? But we could have an English Pinot Noir this year.
We could have a good quality English Pinot Noir this year.
Well, that would be really exciting. Right. The dessert?
The dessert, we went for something very classic. It's an Eton mess sundae, and actually the strawberries are coming from Milton, which is outside Cambridge. And Alice got a great wine to accompany that as well.
Yes, so sweet wines aren't that common in England either. It's just not something we particularly make.
Why is that?
I think it's probably more a commercial choice than strictly to do with... Well, we don't have the conditions to make ice wine, for example. You need to leave the grapes and let them frost over before picking them. We don't have the... And we actually will struggle with conditions for late harvest wines because... September, October rainfall will just mean the grapes will rot, and so that's probably more the reason why, but also a commercial choice that sweet wines aren't the easiest to sell. But we do have a lovely demi-sec sparkling wine here. So demi-sec is a sweeter style of sparkling wine. It's got to have between 32 and 50 grams of sugar per litre. This one's from a producer called Nightimber, and it's a really lovely, it's actually 100% Chardonnay Blanc de Blanc wine, but with that little bit of extra residual sugar that makes it really delicious with anything such as Eton mess, Victoria sandwiches, etc., Victoria sponge, all of that. Yeah.
And all of these wines presumably are on sale at Cambridge Wine Merchants.
Absolutely, they certainly are. Yeah.
And did you choose them?
I purchased all of these for the company, yes, actually. And I did, yeah. So Exton Park, which we're having as a welcome drink, that was a producer I came across about 3 years ago and was really keen on. Just started working with them. Rathviny, They only released their first wine on June the 1st, so we really are. This is going to be one of the earliest showings of these wines. Trappel Down, been working with them for a few years, and Night Timber as well. Yeah.
Oh, lovely. What a nice job.
I know, it's not bad.
Could you give us the detail, Alex, of when this event is taking place?
So this evening is taking place on Friday the 20th of July at Robinson College in Cambridge, and it will start at 7 o'clock. And the ticket is £42 per person, which includes the three-course dinner and one glass of wine with each course as well. And we're very lucky because Alice Archer will be joining us this evening and will be presenting each wine as well. So as much as having food and drink during the evening, it's all about getting or giving some knowledge to the guests as well and having some...
Yeah, I think people will find that pretty interesting. Is this the sort of thing you normally do, Alice?
Yes, yeah, I do this quite often. I quite like being described as the entertainment there.
To what extent, when people buy wine for themselves, are they thinking about the food they're going to have it with, or are they just thinking about drinking it without food? And is there a change in that, do you think?
From the Cambridge Wine Merchant's perspective, so certainly we're looking at people who choose to go into an independent wine merchant to then also take advantage of what that independent wine merchant offers, which is one-to-one help, which is you can go in, you can ask, you can't necessarily go into a supermarket and ask someone, what would you recommend with this? So we find a lot of people asking for something specific to go with a meal that they're having or that they're taking around to someone that's doing a dinner party. We've even had people coming into our shops with recipe books and say, I'm cooking this. What do you think would go with this? I regularly get emails and requests from various either private clients or colleges, etc. What should we match with this particular meal? It's certainly something that's becoming a lot more conscious in people's minds are we serving the white wine with the right food?
Yeah.
And if you'd like to attend that dinner, you can book by emailing celebrations@robinson.cam.ac.uk, or you can phone Cambridge 332 859. It's on, and it starts at 7 for 7:30. Cost is £42.
Yes, indeed. We often see headlines in newspapers, often the Daily Express, the Daily Mail, about some scientific research that helps you to, I don't know, live longer or reduces your blood pressure. Drink more gin and you'll lose weight, that sort of thing. And then the next week, another headline saying the exact opposite of what that said. And I think what not very many people know is that the NHS, on part of its website called Behind the News, so you can find it by putting in Behind the News NHS, analyses the science behind a lot of these stories. So recently, the Mail Online published a story under the heading, Eating Whatever You Want Between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Boosts Weight Loss After Just 12 Weeks. Which sounds improbable. Mm. But anyway, the NHS has done an analysis of the research, and it's a sort of variant of the 5-2 diet, where you eat normally on 5 days and fast on 2 days. In this, you fast for 16 hours and you eat between the hours of 10 and 6, i.e. an 8-hour span. And the experiment was done on 23 adults, and they did report weight loss, a 3% loss of body weight. The website analyses this, and the conclusion says that it was a nice attempt at examining the effect of time-restricted feeding on body weight and risk factors for metabolic diseases that increase the risk of heart disease, stroke and diabetes. But there were limitations, and they go through these limitations, one of which was to do with the control group.
Mm.
But another was the participants reported themselves what they had eaten, and as the study points out, they tend to be inaccurate because people tend to forget or lie about exactly what they have eaten.
Yes.
And also, most of the participants were women, so the results may not be applicable to men. And another point they make is that 12 weeks is quite short for a trial, but anyway. And finally, the findings were based on adults who were obese but otherwise healthy. And although they don't say it here, it made me wonder. I mean, obviously, we're not all obese, so would the findings be different for other people? But also, maybe obese people would be slightly less likely to be completely honest about what they're eating. So the conclusion was that really the results aren't valid and more research is needed. Mm. But an interesting website to look at, NHS Behind the Headlines.
Good. Now, one of the most highly rated local chefs is Alex Rushmer. His hole-in-the-wall restaurant is still sorely missed, but what is his guilty food secret?
I'm half Swedish, and the Swedes have a real love of hot dogs, and that's something that I think is genetic. So if I'm ever feeling really, really sort of hungry and don't have much time to cook, then a hot dog in a fluffy white roll with ketchup and mustard and fried onions, a little bit of chili sauce, I think I could have about 4 or 5 of those, no trouble.
Well, Alex is another chef who's planning on opening a Central Cambridge restaurant this year.
Yeah, there's a sort of renaissance in Cambridge food at the moment, with new restaurants coming from Alex, one coming from Mark Poynton, and also the opening of Parker's Tavern and the rejuvenation of Restaurant 22. It's looking good. It's great.
Really is. And now some news of free food available in Cambridge, which you can find on the Olio app. Jane down Coleridge Road has some vine tomatoes and mushrooms to give away. She's also got a Turkish Delight bar, if you fancy that, for National Chocolate Day. And meanwhile, Alice is offering some leftover cake from a cream tea at Harriet's. So this includes a scone, a macaron and a jam tart. And Alice is on Catherine Street. And also, just as a little tip of the hat, Olio is celebrating. It's picked up now 500,000 users.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Really good. So the more the merrier.
Do you think that's because of us?
I like to think so, yes. Oh, dear.
By the way, Matt, sorry, can I just interrupt and say that we didn't say the date of the Robinson College British Food and English Wine. Entirely my fault. It's the 20th of July.
Ah, okay. Okay. 20th of July.
Yeah.
So on to our next feature, the more food secrets now. Gemma Whiting runs Linton Kitchen, and she will be followed by Jan and Paney from Souvlaki Shack.
Do you have any guilty food secrets?
Guilty food secrets? Well, I mean, I am a sugar addict because I own a bakery. So literally everywhere I go, I buy so much cake and I just want a spoonful of it to taste and see how different people have done it. But that's not a guilty secret. I'm just a cakehead.
One last question. Guilty food secret.
What's yours?
Oh my God. Oh, wait. I don't know if I can even say this. Fish finger sandwiches. Although if we're being really good, and because we're in the waste not whatnot, fish finger pitters.
Fish finger pitters. Yes. I like it.
Yeah, we make our own bread. Yeah. So fish finger pitters are the way forward.
Brilliant.
Obviously, being from a Greek background, you think it would be. But I love a good shepherd's pie. Mm. It's my thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
A really good quality shepherd's pie. Mm. Yeah, so just good comfort
food.
Comfort.
Good comfort food.
Yeah, no, that's true.
There we are.
Lovely.
God, fish finger sandwiches and pitters, I do agree with that. Now, this period of hot, dry weather, it is very welcome, but it is proving difficult for growers of fruit and veg. Here is Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments with some advice and observations.
So, Alan, I just want to show you this cabbage, which I cut yesterday. So, actually, a spring cabbage. I've cut it a little bit late, but you can see there's a good firm head there. And actually, look, it's still dripping water, even though I cut it last night. And here's the stem and the root, and I think we can see there's a good strong root system there. Some of the roots were maybe 15 centimetres long in the ground, spreading out all directions from the stem, which itself is very hard and is going to retain water. That's a cabbage which was sown almost a year ago, sown last August, and then planted out September, October, and then has remained really quite small to the eye all winter and early spring, but all that time it was developing this strong root system, and so I think that's one of the crops which has done fine even though we've had this really hot extended dry spell, because it had established a strong root system. By contrast, this is a cucumber. It's an annual, and so I sowed that in April probably, and raised it in the polytunnel for a while, and then planted it out maybe 5 or 6 weeks ago, and it's still struggling. A lot of the leaves are yellow and pallid. There is a bit of new growth coming that's darker green with some flowers on, so I think it will make it in the end, but it won't be so brilliant. But along the same row, we've got some much healthier looking plants, which are all the leaves are dark green, the stems are strong, they're going upwards, they look great. And the difference here is that this the seed that was put in straight in the ground in May, you can see there's quite a lot of manure and compost in this row. But of course I have actually been watering these just to get them to germinate.
And because it's surrounded by compost and so on, it's a fairly retentive environment, water retentive environment.
Yeah, I mean more moisture retentive than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, these conditions are pretty extreme. So, yeah.
Yeah.
If the plant, we're talking about annual plants primarily here, because these are the ones that are going to be in trouble, unlike that biennial cabbage we looked at. If they can get away, then lack of water might mean that the plant tries harder to find water. So in the case of a carrot, for example, that's going to lead to a long, straight taproot, developing it as the plant searches for water. And then when it finally does find some, either by reaching water further down or when the rains finally come, then it'll swell up and produce a nice long straight carrot, perhaps even a prize winning carrot. So if the annuals can get established, then I think a period of drought isn't necessarily a bad thing.
You don't see wilted trees very often.
No, you don't, and the reason for that
and that will be the root system, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah. So they've got a well established root system, and so I think they're perhaps a bit of advice looking to the future, if we are going to have more extremes of weather, is consider planting a few more perennials, because they're going to be much more resilient to weather. So here's my quince tree, and yeah, looking healthy. Lots of small, what do we call them, quincelets, the little fruits. Yeah, pear shapes, about 4 or 5 centimetres long already, swelling nicely, good quality.
Yeah.
Happy with that at the moment. You might notice I've got this little path cut through to the tree. So I've got this sort of rather drastic watering method where I fill up a wheelbarrow with water from the trough and then bring it around down this path at increasing speed until I just tip it somewhere near the tree. And you know, I think if you are going to water things, then give them a really good soaking if you possibly can. Don't sprinkle everything.
But if you do sprinkle,
more likely that most of your water is just going to evaporate quite quickly, so it doesn't have time to soak in. Unless you've mulched, of course, which is putting some organic matter on the top, which reduces evaporation, and as well as feeding the soil and preventing and impeding the growth of weeds as well.
Yeah.
The soft fruit is not so good. So black currants. Yeah, we can see a few leaves dying off, but the main issue I've noticed with the black currants, which are ripe now and they're probably at their peak now actually, is the size of the fruits, just quite small relatively. So a bit disappointing there. So yeah, lack of water, that's definitely the cause.
Lack
there.
Of water, yeah, small fruit in the black currants case. Yeah. Okay, so you've mentioned prevention, water your crops, but is there a longer term solution?
I think focusing more on perennials, even some biennials, like we saw that spring cabbage that did well, but mulching the ground and also making sure there's plenty of organic matter in the soil, which helps to retain moisture. So they're two good techniques. You asked about reduction in crop size, but you can also see the effect of drying out in that a weaker plant is more liable to be infested by pests or perhaps subject to disease. So it's been a really good year for black fly, I've noticed. So they seem to be on almost everything. Anything that grows tall with a flowering tip seems to have black fly on it at the moment. So, you know, a weaker plant is more likely to get attacked.
Right. So another good reason for reducing water loss.
Yeah, absolutely. So here we're doing some mulching of these tomatoes. These are bush tomatoes. I didn't mulch these as thoroughly as I normally would earlier this year, and this is where we're going to learn that it's better to mulch early than mulch late, because you get not just because you get the water conservation effect earlier, but because
it's harder to actually get the mulch underneath without damaging your crop.
And what can people use for mulch?
Well, this, I recommend, this hay from Trumpington Meadows.
But things like lawn clippings would do.
Yeah, you don't get as much bulk unless you've got an enormous lawn or you've got neighbours with an enormous... There's a good one, by the way. Ask your neighbours to give you their lawn mowings. Fact is, with all these annual vegetables, you're up against it because they've got to do everything in one season. We had a really late start this spring as well. Let's not forget how cold it was all the way through to the end, almost to the end of April. So that meant that the time we had to get crops in and for them to get root systems established was so much reduced.
And something else that you've mentioned previously is having your plants in almost a slight hollow so that water can gather in that hollow if it ever does rain or if you water it.
Yeah, that's right. When you make a planting hole, make it deep enough that you can shape the soil into a little depression where the plant stem is. Or alternatively, if you do find that you've planted it a bit too high, then just get some soil from elsewhere and make a little ring around it, a little barrier that's going to hold the moisture in.
Great. Okay. Thanks very much, Dave.
My pleasure.
And that was Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments. And let's just go on now to one more guilty food secret.
Yeah, this is Andrew Samolonis from Gourmet Brownies.
Oh, guilty food secret. I would say for me is a bacon sandwich. I really, as people quite often come to me and say, how come I don't look so large having, stood behind a stall of brownies all day? And I think if we sold bacon sandwiches, I'd be in trouble.
Some people are guilty about, quite acceptable things, really. Andrew with bacon sandwiches, and before that, Paini and shepherd's pie.
Yeah, maybe they eat them in bulk or something. But anyway, are you going to tell us what yours is, Alan?
Next time, Matt. Next time, I promise.
And there's green onions signalling the start of our news section. And we begin with jobs.
Yeah, the Petersfield in Sturton Street wants a chef de partie. You need a year's experience in that role working with fresh food and pop in with your CV. A chef de partie is also needed by the Trinity in Trinity Lane. Again, pop in with your CV or phone Cambridge 322 130 for a chat about it. And finally, a senior sous chef is needed at the Ivy, also in Trinity Lane, next door to the Ivy, in fact, next door to the Trinity, in fact. And the closing date is next Friday. Apply via their website.
And as we mentioned earlier, Parker's Tavern in the University Arms Hotel in Regent Street is opening on the 1st of August, and it is taking bookings now for breakfast, lunch and dinner.
And on the subject of openings, old news now, but Mark Poynton has left Alimentum and is setting up at a venue soon in central Cambridge. Until that happens, he is having pop-ups around the city, and if you want to go to one, you need to move quickly and quicker than I've managed so far. To get the details, go to mjprestaurant.com and there you can subscribe to Mark's emails, which tell you where they're going to be and when. In fact, he announced yesterday that the next one will be this coming Wednesday, but it is now sold out.
Okay, and finally, Carrico Tapas and Cambridge Wine Merchants are organising a tapas and wine evening tasting series again. This is the third year they've done it, and they want to turn these events into a real foodie experience where you not only get to enjoy, but you learn and you gain a wider knowledge of food and drink. Now, the tapas and wine tastings will be held at the Cambridge Wine Merchants Cherry Hinton Road branch. That'll be every other month, and each month they will focus on a particular Spanish region. So the tasting will include 5 tapa and 5 wines for £34. There's one next week on Wednesday, and it will feature the East Coast, that's Catalonia and Valencia. And future dates are the 19th of September, covering Madrid and Castilla-La Mancha, and on the 14th of November, the north of Spain, so Galicia, Asturias and Cantabria. You can book tickets via Eventbrite or phone in Cambridge 214 553.
And that's all we have time for today. If you missed some or just want to hear the whole thing all over again, remember, we're on alternative Saturdays at noon, repeated on Sunday at 2, and then podcast early in the next week.
And if you'd like to get in touch with us with any news or comment when we're off the air, you can email us flavour@cambridge105.co.uk or contact us on Twitter @flavour105. And coming up next on Cambridge 105 Radio this Sunday afternoon, Pete Butchers returns with another episode of Jazz Today, featuring, amongst others, tracks from saxophonist David Liebman, guitarist Sam O'Salomon, and trio HLK, who are a band performing in the city later this month. Plus, there's a rundown of jazz events coming up in Cambridge. At 5 p.m, it's Polish Waves, the show presented in English and Polish, with a mix of music from Polish artists and events from around the city and South Cambridgeshire. Then from 6 till 7, Jack Swindlehurst brings you Summer Sports Week, looking at both national and local sports. And at 7 p.m, Tony Barnfield returns with Easy on the Ear, looking at lighter music from the BBC Proms, which began on Friday. All this and plenty more taking you right through your Sunday evening's listening on Cambridge 105 Radio.
But that's all we've got time for today. We'll be back on July the 20th, but until then...
Goodbye! Goodbye.